All sides are now on the conference line in a listen-only mode. I'd like to turn the presentation over to your moderator today, Ms. Joycey Hurst. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Good morning to those of you in the West, and good afternoon to us Easterners. We are about to have our first call in a series on enhancing services in natural environments. This call series is sponsored by the OSEP Community of Practice on Part C Settings, or Natural Environments. The facilitators of the community are the National Early Childhood TA Center and the Southeast Regional Resource Center. I'm Joycey Hurst at NECTAC, and our team of facilitators include Linda Fletcher at NECTAC and Elizabeth Jackson at CERC, who the two of them together really did the bulk of the work on this call, and we greatly appreciate their efforts. Additionally, Delia Serpa at CERC, Cal Black, and Sharon Ringwall at NECTAC, and the technology support units at both NECTAC and CERC have contributed to this effort. Mary Beth Bruder is our first presenter. We are very pleased to have Mary Beth. I'd like to turn the call now over to Linda Fletcher to introduce her to you all.
It's a great privilege for me to be able to introduce Dr. Mary Beth Bruder to you. She has worked in early intervention for over 28 years with a real passion for the field. She's been involved in design, provision, evaluation of early intervention services within a number of states and across a variety of agencies. Has worked with early intervention systems, special education, child care, Head Start. Dr. Bruder's held faculty appointments at Virginia Commonwealth University, New York Medical College, and since 1986 at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, where she's currently a professor of pediatrics and educational psychology. She also serves on the boards of a number of journals. She has special interest in the inclusion of children with special needs in early childhood and school settings. Recently, she has at the University of Connecticut a research and training center on service coordination, a grant in personnel preparation, and she's also connected with the Center for Social, Emotional, and the Early Childhood Outcomes Center. So I think she comes to us not only with education and background, but lots of experience in the field to be able to speak to us today about enhancing services in natural environments. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Linda. And hi, everybody. And the best news is I just got on, so it must be clearing out. So I have my PowerPoint in front of me, both on the computer and the hard copy, since both NECTAC and myself were struggling for about a half an hour to figure out why we couldn't access the web.
Great.
I really appreciate this opportunity to kicking off this series, because I think that this construct, which is natural environments, is something that has been causing a lot of dissension and a lot of challenges in the field. And yet, when we boil down to the very basics of how kids learn, the natural environment construct really just becomes a concept of good practice for learning. So what I hope to do today is walk through an outline that I'm very happy that NECTAC is providing to all the presenters. So for those of you who are going to be hearing multiple having multiple opportunities to hear the presenters over the next weeks, everybody will be touching on these same key points. And I think that will help everybody integrate and see that all of us are more similar than different, and that we're, again, all focusing on how can we enhance children's learning and the family's ability to support the special needs of their child. So we're going to start with the first slide, which is a definition of key terms. And I've pulled out some key terms that actually have emanated from a research institute that Carl Dunst and I co-directed a number of years ago called The Role of Families in Their Children's Learning. And through that, we were able to identify, with the assistance of families who let us basically live in their lives for a while, as well as families who answered surveys, find out what was important to families in their everyday lives. And then secondarily, how are children with disabilities accommodated into those everyday activities that occur? The unit and analysis we used was activity setting, and this really came from some other work that had been done in the 80s and 90s, where the activity setting was identified as primarily, and if you want to click, I know I'm kind of going back, we'll come back to a learning opportunity, but click to the next slide, number three. The activity setting has been defined, and this is in our article that Carl did with the rest of our crew. Primarily the definition that's up there is a situation-specific experience, an opportunity or event. So it's not an activity, it's not a routine, but it can be that. But it involves a child's interaction with people, the physical environment, or both. So it's what is a child doing? It provides the context for a child to learn about his or her own abilities and capabilities, as well as what's happening with others around them. So the activity setting is used as a unit of analysis in the research that we did through the Institute, and since then, we have refined it somewhat, but primarily it's still very helpful for me to think about the everyday things kids do can be defined in the type of activity settings that families choose to spend time in. So activity settings can range all the way from what happens out in a playground, not going to the playground, which is a location, but what happens in a playground, whether it's going down the slide, climbing up the stairs, sitting on mom's lap in a swing, rolling a ball to somebody else. It's what a child is doing that involves the child interacting with the people and the physical environment, and it's a context for a child to learn. Activity settings can also be broadened to broadened into other things that families do, such as rituals that they may have, Friday night pizzas, or celebrations that they do, whether it's family celebrations or community celebrations. So the activity setting is really a nice unit to hang on to as we try and observe children's capacity for learning more. The next definition that I've put up here is the definition of learning opportunities, because it's, I think the other thing that we learned from families is how many learning opportunities are occurring daily in their lives and how many opportunities they have to enhance their child's abilities, and they do it just naturally. So learning opportunities are the context in which children can express competence. Now, we had a number of studies, one that involved 3,300 families through a survey, and through that, about 11 different types of activity settings were identified. Subsequently, we did case studies with about 119 families, and we identified a range of locations that families spent time in, both in the home and in the community, as well as the types of activity settings and learning opportunities. And these were children and families who were spread out across the country, who had different types of disabilities and level of disabilities, whose families had different backgrounds and structures, and who lived in either rural, urban, or suburban places. But we really were very, very pleased to see the richness of this data, because on average, families were able to identify, as an example, in the community, up to 76 activity settings. And that's a mean of 106 learning opportunities within that. And that was not inclusive, meaning there was lots of other opportunities that families had. These are just the ones that we captured through the case studies. So what this taught us is really the fact that kids are learning all the time, and our job as early interventionists is really to sit back, observe, and enhance that learning, as opposed to substitute that learning with other types of interventions that we may think are more effective, but quite frankly, we haven't developed the methodology or haven't really collected the data to support that via outcomes and learning. So we felt very strongly in this institute, and I know Carl is going to be speaking to you later next month, that this was the basis. It really was the foundation to begin some work at looking at learning in natural environments. The next slide is the next definition that I wanted to talk about, which is, what does the law say? And the law is pretty clear, and the law has been there almost 20 years. Since 1986, it said very specifically, maximum extent appropriate to the needs of the child, early intervention must be provided in natural environments, including, and this is how they define it, the home or community settings in which children without disabilities participate. And further, they are settings that are natural or normal for the child's age peers who have no disability. So that, to me, again, gave us the framework to look very specifically at what are kids doing in the home and what are kids doing in the community. And, in fact, isn't our job to help children learn to their maximum potential in the home and in the community, which is a very different direction in early intervention than perhaps we had before this was in the law, when we used to have children brought to us and we did things to them. The next slide is just sort of a summary slide of what natural learning environments are, because I think through the Institute, and Carr really made a point of making sure we were able to differentiate between just natural environments being the home or community, but really what our job is in early intervention is to make sure that learning is occurring in these environments. So natural learning environments, the places where children experience everyday typical occurring learning opportunities that promote and enhance behavioral and developmental competencies. I think the importance is primarily remembering that our job is to enhance and to make sure that children are on the right road to learning and becoming more competent. Now, when we look just at a summary of this, I think what we have learned is that location is usually the least important variable, though it has to be there. The foundation is the home or community. What's more important is what happens in the location, the activity settings, that is, that occur, and usually families are the first and the best reporters of what activity settings children are spending time in, what activity settings a family is spending time in, and then they can even break it down to what activity settings are very enjoyable, which is usually where people spend their time, but then we also have activity settings that families and children have to do, such as going to the doctor. And again, we cannot ignore the fact that these or other opportunities for learning occur in these. When we look at learning opportunities, activity settings basically have lots of learning opportunities. Because if you go back to that playground scenario, a child can learn, is using motor competence. If he's on a slide climbing up, he's using communication to talk or communicate through a variety of means. They're also possibly using cognition and problem solving, how to get to the top. Now, children with more severe disabilities also have an ability to have multiple learning opportunities within activity settings. And I think the beauty to me of activity setting analysis is the fact that it does not divide children up into developmental domains nor into specific therapies. It is focusing primarily on competence across participation in what children do in the everyday context which their family have. Now, we'll get in later into intervention, but primarily the basic foundation is the fact that we're looking at children holistically and we're looking at making them reach their potential, both behaviorally and developmentally, through the natural learning opportunities they have in the activity settings that their families choose for them.
Mary Beth, are you moving from slide 6 to 7?
If that's my cue to do it, I'll do it.
No, I'm just wondering.
I wanted to reorient.
Reorient.
Yes. Now we're going to go into 7.
That's good.
Thank you, Linda.
You're welcome.
The next key principles in supporting research, which is 4 points, again, that was provided to me in regard to organizing this, brings me right into the next bridge, which is the purpose of early intervention. And as I started out saying, we're looking holistically at enhancing a child's competence. But the next slide brings us back to the law. And not to belabor the point, but I think the law had some very basic concepts that have sort of been lost as we are developing systems of services. And if we look at what the law said, number one is to enhance the development of infants and toddlers to minimize their potential for developmental delay. And I think we know we're all trying to do that. What we found through activity setting analysis in the families and learning is there are ways that you can do that that actually are better than other ways. If you go right down to the fourth with the underline, I think the piece that we sometimes forget is that also the purpose of early intervention is to enhance the capacity of families to meet the special needs of their infants and toddlers with disabilities. That, again, brings me why activity setting and learning opportunity analysis is so important. Because, as I said at another NECTAC, I think there was a video conference about 7 years ago. I can't even remember. My mind is so blurry. And we were first starting to talk about this area. We're saying, you know, we need to recognize the fact that no matter how many hours we have our hands on children, the families have more hours with this child. This child is living in the context of the everyday experiences their family provides many more minutes and hours and days than we are able to put our hands on a child. Therefore, what's the most efficient way to have children learn? And I think when we look at this, the law even told us our job is to enhance the family's capacity, which means the target of intervention. While the child is the one that brings this dyad into intervention, the parent-child dyad, our target is much better focused when we work specifically with the family, both in terms of efficiency and then effectiveness, as families are going to be living with these children more, obviously, hours than we have. The next slide talks about working with families. Well, I think one of the issues we have to remember is that early intervention and natural environments are not two independent variables. And early intervention can be looked at as the big umbrella, and clearly we could have a dialogue some other time about what is early intervention. But for the most part, we have to remember that early intervention has a number of key components if we're going to do recommended best practice. And of course, family-centered, which is the slide that's up there, is first and foremost one of those components. And that slide, comes right after the notion of our purpose is to enhance capacity. Well, we also want to do it in a family-centered mechanism. Lots of research out there, so family-centered started out as a philosophy, but has data behind it now in terms of practices. And it primarily is supporting families in their natural caregiving roles, as well as promoting normal patterns of living and family collaboration and choice. And I think the point there is we want to provide that in the context of data-based decisions. That is, we have long passed some times when we used to prescribe treatments or have families do treatments that we know right now have no data behind them. And so why would we give families a choice to take part in a service or a support that not done the best way we know how? And I think that's the whole point of choice, is making sure it's in the context of best practice with evidence behind it. But family-centered is but one. We also have to remember that with family-centered, another key component of early intervention is a team-based service delivery. While I strongly believe that we're teaching children and treating them holistically, we need to make sure that we do have expertise across developmental domains. And right now, we know that most early intervention providers come to us and come to this relationship with families with a discipline behind them. That is, they are specifically trained in a discipline, and this discipline may or may not have provided them opportunities to learn things such as how to work with other disciplines, how to work with families, and how to do this in a context of everyday living. So the teaming aspect cannot be negated in any way under natural environments as we look holistically. And then, of course, the one last thing I want to just talk about before we move on is curriculum. Because one of the things we have to remember is that a whole sequence of opportunities for learning is another name for curriculum. And very rarely have we really sat down and discussed what type of curriculum orientation are we going to take if, in fact, we're going to be focusing on enhancing children's capacity. Many times, what we're doing with kids in terms of how they learn is we take objectives or outcomes from either the parent, what the parents want, and we know the parents want usually the big three, as any parent, including myself, wants. You want your child to talk and to walk and to be social. And, of course, take care of themselves. So there's another one. But those are the basics. But when you look at how providers and interventionists are also looking at how children learn, many times we take it from developmental assessments, and we look at items that the child has mastered and then take the next set of items, usually domain and discipline specific, and write those up on the IFSP. And one of the things I want to bring us back to again is that holistic. So if you switch to the next slide.
Can Mary Beth?
Excuse me?
Can?
Yep. This is something else from the Families and Learning. It's a slide that primarily talks about creating learning opportunities. And if you just take a step back and think about yourselves as adult learners, and then we can obviously apply it to children, we usually do what we're most interested in. We also usually do what we're good at. So our interest level helps make us competent, which means that an interest leads for us to get involved in something. We become engaged until we become competent. After competence, we will master it, and then we have another interest. Now, that's a very simplistic, single-focused model, and that usually is happening a billion times a day on different things that you run into or things that you want to learn about or things that you have to learn about. When you think about kids, very rarely have we focused on the interests and the engagement. in early intervention, I must say that I think in a lot of times we focus primarily on acquisition or competence, and sometimes not even mastery, just did he do it or not do it, instead of following interests and allowing engagement to occur in a naturalized opportunity. So when we look at learning, this transcends domains, disciplines, therapists, however you want to structure your early intervention. This primarily should be an umbrella under which all learning should happen. Which brings me to number 11, which is the role and qualities of providers. And you know what? I just realized this is out of order. Do I not have 11? Sorry, guys.
Mary Beth, your role of providers?
13. 13. Yep. All right. Let's go to, this is the problem of not being able to get online. I'm sorry. Let's go back to 11. The situated learning just takes the learning paradigm one step forward, which talks very specifically that if we're going to look at learning holistically, again, across discipline domains, we're going to look at learning that is embedded in everyday natural environments, emphasizes the acquisition of functional competence, makes possible increased child participation, and is social and non-social. And that's just another word, again, for learning that happens in everyday activities. The intervention strategies, and this is just, again, taken from the study that we did in the type of instructional practices that we had families actually use within the everyday activity settings. And primarily, it's teaching people, and most families do this naturally, to respond to more attempts at the child to gain competence and to do it in a way that primarily is contingent on the child doing the appropriate response and shaping that response. Incidental teaching primarily means focusing in on the environment as one of the mediators and allowing opportunities for child to demonstrate competence. And responsive teaching is putting everything that we're doing with the child in the context of being responsive to their initiations. Now the next one, which is where I wanted to end up, which is the role of service providers in the law. And pretty much summarizing this whole section of the key principles, when we look at what the law says in particular that each state has to hire the personnel who meet the highest standard in their discipline, okay? But it then also says the role. So we know that standards are kind of the entry level or your ticket in the door to provide early intervention. But then your role is the next step. It's to enhance what you do. And basically the law says, and this comes right out of 1986, it says that our job as service providers is to consult with parents and other providers and representatives of appropriate community agencies, again getting into where they wanted the location of natural of services and natural environments, to ensure effective, and of course that's the key to me, effective provision. Number two, training parents and others regarding the provision of those services. So training parents and others can be teammates, but it certainly can be people who are in these children's lives. And then thirdly, participating in the multidisciplinary team's assessment of a child and child's family. But here's the kicker. In the development of integrated goals and outcomes for the IFSP. The integrated goals and outcomes is an elusive dream for many, many states. Because as we've looked at multiple studies that have looked at IFSPs, we unfortunately are still doing IFSPs very discipline driven. And I do know, I'm not ignoring the fact that funding, unfortunately, tends to require that. But I do think that gives us an additional challenge for how to do what the law asks us and then still be able to turn it in for reimbursement purposes if that's what's driving us. But what I'd like to do, at least for the next hour, is to kind of focus more on what we're doing with kids and less about how we're paying for it. And I'm not being naive or ignoring that. But just for now, let's talk about how kids learn. If we truly were looking at activity settings as a unit from which to gain outcomes from families and enhance learning opportunities to provide opportunities for competence, the integrated goals and outcomes would be very easy to do. Also, the consulting with parents and other service providers starts off with doing the assessment in a consultation manner with the family of what's important to them, what does the child do, and then enhancing the parent's ability and others' ability to facilitate learning. Now, one of the things, and Linda did mention, we actually have a 5-year personnel preparation institute that the feds have funded. We've just finished, for some of you on the lines, we thank you very dearly, a Part B 619 and a Part C survey, which we had about 48 states participate in which we looked at personnel standards. And indeed, most states are doing highest standard within a specific discipline. But this next step, which is how do we teach people to do what the law said, and how do we focus on some of the key components of early intervention, such as families, teaming, natural learning opportunities, doesn't happen if we're just going to rely on people to come out of their own discipline-specific training program. Another study Carl and I are just finishing is a pilot study for a larger study that also, if you're on the line and you're doing our largest study on personnel prep practices in higher ed, we thank you too. But this first pilot study pretty much documented for us that not all disciplines are getting the same emphasis in training on specific practices across some of these key components, which lets you know that our workforce is undertrained in these areas, unless, and I say this unless, they've come out of a program that is totally focused on preparing them to teach under, or treat and teach under Part C. And we know, unfortunately, that many state programs don't do that because licensure, in order to get licensed, you have to have competence at the adult area as well as child area. So this whole piece right here, I think, is key in terms of building competence of our workforce and intervention by demanding us to pay attention to skills that we need beyond what we get in our discipline-specific training. And in fact, in those states that are doing a credential or starting to do a credential, they also have recognized this and are realizing that if we're ever going to help children learn the best we can, that we need to enhance our provider's capacity to be able to deliver services in this manner. Now, the next slide takes us into this IFSC process and how do we adapt that. And let me just flip here. This outline in front of you, for those of you who don't have it, I'll just read it for you. I'm going to embed within the next couple of slides, so I'm not going to take each one of them separately like I did the last. But the outline talks about gathering information from families, which we know is the first step in developing a good IFSP, evaluation and assessment, the IFSP development, ongoing implementation in natural environments, and special considerations for working with various cultures and language backgrounds. I'm going to start actually with that last one, because I didn't put any slides together on that. I just want to emphasize that in the research institute that Carl and I did, and lots of other people around the country did with us, we had various cultures and language backgrounds represented. And in fact, most of those families were able to identify as many natural learning opportunities, i.e. activity settings, as well as the learning opportunities as other families. And what we found is that some of the basic principles that are family-centered transcend cultures. Not to say that we don't need interpreters at times and we don't need to clearly understand people's values, because one of the things we found is there was a very big clash between what families wanted to do and the traditional service system that they were interfacing with. And when we were able to go in there and do activity setting analysis, it was very easy for us to see all the learning opportunities. So if we're able to change our framework and work a little differently, I think we will have less clashing of cultures and values and more focus on what's important to the family for the child to learn. The next slide has pieces from an IFSP model that we have developed. And there's three major components to this. The first is to be able to be competent and to be able to demonstrate family-centered practices, listening and being responsive. Now, that sounds very easy, and it sounds almost overly simplistic. However, what it truly means is putting yourself in the position of letting the family lead. And that means understanding good communication strategies such as probing, reflective listening, and actually letting that, we always have a saying, which is letting the parent talk first and often. Because what you want to do is set a partnership up early in which the family understands that we are enhancing their abilities and that we're there to support them. So we do need to teach our providers what listening is all about and being responsive. I do fear that our strategies in IFSP meetings tend to set us up for failure in this, because we usually try and do IFSP meetings in everybody's schedule when we can get everybody there, and people are under time. So I think sometimes providers feel that their time has to be spent just basically delivering the information they got from an assessment or evaluation, and in that case, the parents don't get an opportunity to talk until the very end, or don't get an opportunity to talk until we've all had our say. And I think this means, in this IFSP model, you've really got to stop, and we'll go through a more step-by-step process, and think through what we're trying to do with kids and families. The second is team collaboration supporting a primary provider. Again, this is a model that you're going to hear from a couple of the other presenters over the next couple of weeks. And I think the first thing I have to say, like everything I'm presenting today, it's not new. It's sort of bringing us back to our roots in early intervention and why we passed 90, when Part H was just a dream and why it was being crafted the way it was, which natural environments and having providers be consultants. We really looked at some of the information that came out of some of the early work in the 70s, and one of them was done by a UCPA project in New York, which coined the phrase transdisciplinary. And it really happened because UCPA got a grant, and they were just picking up babies to work with, and they had an older model for school age where they had multiple providers in and out, and they felt just common sense that it didn't make sense to bombard a family new with the news, either number one, that their child has a disability, or number two, is at risk for disability, by having multiple people come in and doing little different things to a child who is, you know, less than 2 feet tall. So the transdisciplinary model was coined, there was practiced, and it primarily enables people to practice those skills that we don't necessarily teach in professional training programs, which is how to teach each other some basic competencies of intervening holistically with the child. But I think if you listen to some of the families and you listen to some of the lives that they are leading, and you primarily try and figure out from their point of view what's going to make sense, having three or four different providers coming in, sometimes even having two different providers coming in at two different times a week, and thinking that that's a approach that's going to enhance development is not always the right, really, thought. Because they, number one, could be at odds with each other, or number two, they're each prioritizing certain areas and may not, in fact, know enough development in the other area to know what enhances or inhibits development in their area. Prime example is speech pathology. If you have a child with any kind of tone problem, low or high, you need to have a good basic background in positioning, handling, and how to enhance that tone or inhibit that tone before you're going to require this child to do anything, and I don't even want to say speech, even cognition, anything. And yet so many times we have the teacher going in separate than the PT, separate than the OT, separate than the, who am I leaving out? Speech, OT, PT, teacher, whatever. And I think what we want to foster is a notion that we have to collaborate, and it might make it harder for us. And I do know, again, it's another flag for funding, but the bottom line is if we really want to enhance families' ability to live a quality of life that they want, we want to make this as easy and as effective. And there's not to say that this multiple provider shouldn't be going in two or three times a week to help this family learn some new skills. But I don't know, unless everybody's on the same page, which means we need a lot of teaming time, it happens when we have separate people going in. Now the last point here is the IFSP is derived from and uses child participation in family-identified activity settings as the context for learning. And primarily that means, again, that we're going to build our whole IFSP around what does the family do, what do they like to do, what do they have to do, what do they want their child to become more competent in, primarily to participate in the activity settings they've identified. One of the sad findings that we had in our Learning Opportunities Institute was that families saw early intervention or early childhood special education as separate than family life. Now you might say, well, of course it is. But the point being, families spend time doing different things than happen in early childhood or early intervention. And what do you think they spent more time doing? The stuff that they did as families. Again, from an efficiency point of view, we can't afford in a child's little life to be having two different parallel play tracks going on with people emphasizing or focusing on two different areas. So one of the things we want to do is start with what are those activity settings. The next slide is the IFSP process. And this just takes us through, and it's just walking you through about how you would identify this and how you would do this. And it's certainly not as elegant or as systemic as some of the other models you're going to see over the next couple of weeks. But primarily, it's just kind of getting us into the headset of how you start thinking differently into doing this. The first is to identify the family's concerns, priority, and resources. We know that is part of the law, but primarily what we're saying here is start as a partnership model. One of my students actually said a couple of years ago to me, and this to me was like the bingo about why we're having such difficulty, she said to me, well, you know, we're under such timelines. We have to get the evaluation done, and then if the child's eligible, then we go into the assessment. We have to get the IFSC done within 45 days, and I have to get the therapist out there who have to see the child. We'll start the partnership after the IFSC is done. And to me, it was like, bingo. That's why families basically learn to acquiesce everything to professionals. What it means is giving up some of your control early on and sharing power. And I know we all want to do this. The strategies are then, how do we do this? So the question is, how can you start by building a relationship with the family first and foremost, and taking the time out to identify what's important to that family by just getting to know them without the pressure of, I've got to get this therapist out, I've got to put this in, on and on and on. I think very rarely do we think about putting the shoes on of this family, whether they're new to the process or whether they're third IFSP, about what this must be like for them. And I think the first thing any family wants to know is that we're here to help, and tell us how we can do that. And giving them an opportunity to feel us out and us to get to know them, both in regard to their priorities, but also who they are, what's important to their family, who is in their family, what brought them to early intervention, what's their history, having a dialogue. The second point is actually identifying the activity settings. And primarily, this can be in that first dialogue. Tell us what you do. Tell us what's difficult for him. How did you identify that you needed help? And in some cases, parents didn't identify it. Other people did. And just say, well, where do you think he has some issues at home? What kinds of things do you find difficult? What kinds of things does he like to do? You're basically demonstrating interest in this child and this family in the context of where they spend most of their time. The third piece is the evaluation. And this is certainly not a day one you do this, day two you do this. This can be fluid, and it should be fluid and dynamic, is identifying the strengths and needs in the context of family's activity settings using functional assessment strategies. Now, you can, though it is challenging, also do an evaluation in this mode. Primarily, if you use evaluation tools that allow parent report, that allow parent participation, and allow a lot of dialogue. I think that, unfortunately, we still are doing evaluation / assessments in the mode that we know is worst case scenario. And I think it was Jack Nisworth who used this quote, which is, assessment in early intervention is strange situations with strange people for the briefest amount of time possible to try and come up with a picture of the child. And again, that just sort of reminds us that what we're putting this child through is just not real life. So what we want this evaluation / assessment to be, and as I said, you can separate it out, no matter what, though, you want the family participating in it, whether they're helping the child in terms of positioning or handling, or whether they're reporting to you, but you don't want this thing done to them. You want them to understand that we're here together, because we know the first assessment can be a very powerful intervention for the family also. After we have what the child is able to do in those activity settings that matter most to the family, and that could be done parent report, it could be done video cam, which I think we need to get a lot more sophisticated in doing, meaning ask the family to video and let us look at it. And it certainly could be doing by observation, asking, can you show me how? Or maybe I should come during lunch so I can see how he eats. Or maybe let's get him on the floor and you just do what you normally do and let me watch. That's the kind of information we need in order to come down to the next, which is identifying collaborative outcomes. And the outcomes on the IFSP, I have just identified three areas that I think IFSPs need to focus on. One is enhancing family capacity. That goes back to the law. The second is child confidence, but I have put that second because I think family capacity is where we put our energy in terms of enhancing child confidence. And then to expand the number and type of activity settings that family and child can participate in. And that goes everywhere from enabling a family person to be able to take the child out to McDonald's, to being able to take them shopping, to be able to take them to the parade. How do we help this family be able to accommodate this child's needs within the activity setting and then take it the next step further, enhance their capacity, and learn new competencies along the way? Now, that's only step one, and unfortunately, sometimes that's where we stop. Because when we go into the next couple of steps, the first part is getting there. The second part is putting it into play. What we do as a team, which is why I believe in the team-based model has to be there at this point, is discuss with the family the way we can enable participation to occur in activity settings. And what that means is primarily using adaptations, because families often have figured out their own adaptations, some good, some not so good. And what we want to do is help them expand their ability to develop adaptations, as well as what type of supportive strategies need to be used. And then, of course, the intervention strategies. How do we get this child positioned the right way? How do we get this child to primarily stay engaged in this activity? What are the kinds of things we're going to do? And we do this in discussion with the family. Because number one, as I said, it ain't going to work if you're only doing it 1, 2, or even 3 hours a week, and the family has the child a gazillion other hours. Or number two, you want to make sure that it's compatible to where the family wants to be, and they don't feel uncomfortable doing certain things. And I do know families will tell us, yes, it's fine to do this, and then as soon as we leave out the door, they feel uncomfortable doing it, they don't want to do it this way, and they just won't do it. So again, I'm going to the efficiency's sake. Let's make sure that our strategies support the family's ability and help them carry things out in their daily activity settings. Now, this next piece is the piece that, unfortunately, now, in a lot of places, we tend to do the responsibilities before we even get into the intervention strategies. And if you do it that way, you can see why intervention strategies then become either therapist or teacher-specific, as opposed to across all people involved in a team. What we then want to do is assign responsibilities across team members, and primarily who's going to be the primary provider or providers, if you need more than one, and then how are we going to demonstrate collaborative consultation as we go forward doing this. Now, collaborative consultation in and of itself is a whole background, and this is one of the old basics, also came out of the 80s, early 80s, and primarily was used in school-aged reform in looking at how to enable a child with learning difficulties to be engaged in a classroom. But we've used it in early intervention fairly successfully, and it's primarily an interactive process, and people have to be able to generate creative solutions together. There's a number of principles that go along with collaborative consultation, such as mutual ownership of the process. How many times have we tried to get somebody to do something and they really don't own it, so they're never going to do it? It's similar to the example I gave of the parent who doesn't really want to do what you've asked them to do, so they're not going to do it. So this is another skill that has to be provided to our interventionists, how to do true collaborative consultation, which is ownership, recognizing what we have to do with each other, and then teaching each other, going back to what the law says, the role of providers, consulting with each other, teaching each other, and then integrating our goals and outcomes. And then building capacity in the community. This means that we are not satisfied with just making sure that we do good stuff with the kids and the families. What we want to do is make sure anybody who touches this kid, who sees this kid, whether it's their religious instruction nursery school all the way to the people they see obviously in child care, but also their neighbors. What happens when mom goes on a play date? Can the neighbor know how to accommodate this child? We have somebody on our staff who has a child who's wearing hearing aids and right now having a very difficult time because the community is not embracing this child, nor are the younger children and their families. So I think early intervention's job primarily is to help families, and by helping families, we're enabling the community to embrace children's needs. And it means that we have to think more broadly about our role. And then lastly, evaluating progress. And this goes without saying, but unfortunately, I think far too many times we focus on just progress notes. And kids do progress. And I say this tongue-in-cheek, but kids do develop. And sometimes it doesn't matter whether we're there or not there, and sometimes we can inhibit development. And I think we have to own that, and to the point that we want to take very good record-keeping and data on our re-enhancing children's learning, because that's why we're all in this field. We want to help kids learn, and we certainly know that the best way to do that is through families, so we have to be able to be competent in this family arena. The next two forms just give you quick and dirty, and again, this comes from the Families and Learning Research Institute. This was done with our families in the case studies, and we've kind of used it now for intervention. But this first one that's on page 18 primarily gives you an opportunity to just record in that very first contact with families, or the second when you're getting to know and establish the partnership, where you can just say, tell me some of the things that your child and you do that you like to do, some of the things that you have to do, and then what are some things you really wish you could do or you wish he could participate in? And you're able to really gather from them what their everyday experiences are like. The second page, again, these were used in the NECTAC conference, video conference a gazillion years ago, the activity setting intervention form. Now, I'm going to walk you through this. We usually don't do location. You know, that's somehow where we got lost. We thought that natural environments just meant the location. But what we really want to know is what's happening in the location. So we usually start with the activity settings as taken from that first form or taken from a dialogue. What's an activity setting a child is spending time in? So let's say swimming in the pool, and I do believe that was the family on the last conference that actually said spending time in the pool or swimming in the pool was the activity setting, and the location was in their backyard. How often? Let's even say 3 times a week, because if I remember, that mom lived in Texas. What is the learning opportunity? Now, this is where it's difficult, and this is where we go back to those skills that I said interventionists need to have, which is responsive communication strategies, including listening, because all of us who have gone through early intervention training programs and have been out there and about, we could come up with 89,000 learning opportunities. And what we want to say instead is let the parent tell us what do they think their child is learning or could learn in that specific situation. And in the swimming pool, learning opportunity could be to use their arms, could be to vocalize, whatever is important to the family. And then we go to that next step, and I thank Mary Anketell and the crew from Pennsylvania who gave us that last one, which primarily is why is that important. Because what that does is it turns it around to the family so they actually start questioning, why is that important? What do I want out of this child to learn? Where do I want him to go? And, of course, if it's using their arms so they can use their arms to play more, if it's making sounds, it could be because I want him to communicate. And that why is important actually boils down to some very nice outcome statements after you have a number of activity settings on there. Now, can that be turned into the IFSP? I think it can. It's a very different way of doing the IFSP. As somebody once told us after we had presented, this is an upside down and backwards way of doing based on, you know, how they're currently doing it. And it truly is. It's a different way of thinking, and it's a focus primarily on learning and the outcome of learning, which is to enhance the family's capacity to meet the special needs of their child. So as we focus on developing an IFSP, we want to make sure it truly reflects the activity settings or those everyday experiences that families value, that they spend time doing, that they like to do, and even those they have to do. And we are then really enabling them to have opportunities to practice this over and over, which is what we know enables us to become competent in something. These are just forms that, you know, again, can be adapted, can be used, don't have to be used. Primarily ending right now. On page 20, we have a project, we have a grant, we primarily are looking only for folks who are interested in systems change training as opposed to going out and just doing IFSP training. We do have an IFSP manual that we make available to those folks who are doing systems change training. We have follow-up. Costs are usually maybe transportation costs, but I'm not really here to talk specifically about what we can do. It's really to try and lay the basis of where we need to go in this field as we sort of move past natural environments and focus on the right variable of how kids learn and how we enhance families' ability to help them learn. And I think I've talked long enough, Linda, so let's hear some questions.
At this time, if there are any questions, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone, and to withdraw your question at any time, you can press the pound key. Once again, if you do have any questions, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone, and we'll wait a few moments to let people queue up. We'll take our first question from the side of Sue Brown of HI Early Intervention. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. This is Don Pyburn from the Early Intervention section in Hawaii.
Hi, Don.
Morning, Dr. Bruder. How are you?
I'm good. I wish I was where you are.
Yeah, it's warm here. We have palm trees and turquoise waters.
Oh.
My question is this. When we talk about capacity enhancing in the community, when the older infants, toddlers are in child care settings, oftentimes the community-based child care folks are getting their training from various state agencies, things like that. And I'm wondering if there is a role for early intervention in trying to collaborate with existing training efforts in the community or with existing community college efforts in trying to spread some of these ideas to the regular early childhood professionals.
Well, Don, I think you know the answer to that one. Of course it is. And I think that this is what I meant about systems change and strategic planning. What we're focusing in on is that we cannot have these silos. I mean, we're just walking down the trail of us all kind of going at odds and ends with each other. Yes, we all need to be on the same page. We all need to be working together. And yes, there are a lot of initiatives, such as the MAPS, which you guys did, that start on a child care basis, but you can't do it in isolation. We need to have all our providers on the same page, a shared vision, you know, going back to old Senge stuff. We need that shared vision for everybody of how to infants and toddlers with disabilities, at risk with disabilities, and even those without disabilities learn, and how do we support that learning in the communities and in homes.
Super. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Once again, if there are any questions, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone now, and to withdraw your question, press the pound key. At this time, we have no further questions. It looks like people decide to queue up. We have a question from Deborah Garneau of the health department. Go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Deb Garneau from the Rhode Island Health Department with Rhode Island's EI program. My question is around the one of the things that our state has done is put in a reimbursement code or billing type code around integrated group, and a lot of what our providers are doing is working with daycare centers and childcare and, you know, places like Gymboree or Music First or however, you know, there's typically developing children and putting, you know, our kids into that setting. And, you know, we found that it is successful, although it's extremely costly. And, you know, one of the, and I'm kind of struggling with, it's not really where the child would have been if we weren't involved. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could, like, share some thoughts on that.
Yeah, considering we've worked very hard with you guys, you know, I think that, I think you answered it, which is where would the child, where is the family spending time with the child? What's the activity settings that are natural for this child? If indeed the child needs a group setting, how would the family have been addressing that with or without your help in Gymboree or childcare? Now, if the child's in childcare because the family's made that choice because they need it, that's obviously where you'd work. But to place a child in childcare or in a Gymboree setting, just so they have access to other peers, I think that's a little bit contrived. Now, I'm not saying it's totally wrong, and I'm not saying a parent might not want that, but I think you do it in partnership with the family. You know, do they want a Gymboree experience? And if so, would they be paying for that themselves out of pocket? And can you then provide the therapist or the teacher or whoever the primary provider to go along with them to help make those connections and adaptations? Because that's the whole point. If some kids need adaptations and supports to participate, that's all our role is. It's not to take over and make this setting so contrived. And in some cases, they don't need that. I don't know if that answered, but I think it's worth sitting down and thinking through.
Right, right. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from the side of Lisa Sharp, Early Access, Iowa Department of Education. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Referring back to when you were talking on page 17, the IFSP process, and you were talking about evaluating progress, we're struggling a little bit with that in Iowa. We're in the process of really looking at our paperwork and revising it so that it's family-centered. And I've been getting lots of questions from, you know, service providers about evaluating progress. And what I've been emphasizing is that that's the family, you know, looking at, you know, what's happening with the outcomes. And we actually have a place on the IFSP. Should we be concerned, you know, with something more than that? Because we're getting all this kind of pressure about, you know, no child left behind and child ready for school and, you know, collecting data. I mean, you know, are we missing something?
Well, I think an easy answer, but it's not the full answer, is that the Early Childhood Outcome Center, which Kathy Hebler is heading up, is charged by the feds to look at some streamlined outcomes for child and family, which is what we have to report to Congress. And that should be, you know, a model for that should be out very soon. And Lynn Kahn from NCTAC is also on that and involved with that. So that's going to give you some direction on where to go. In regard to individual child and family progress, I think that one of the things you want to focus on is what makes most sense to the family. What are they looking for? You know, what are they looking to show that early intervention has made a difference in their life by enhancing either the quality of life or their child's competence in certain areas, or now they can take their child to the swimming pool? You know, different things like that are going to be individualized, and it shouldn't be cumbersome. It should be very focused on that family unit. But as I said, for the larger, either program improvement, community improvement or statewide reporting, hopefully it will be streamlined enough that it will not be as cumbersome as some of the requirements on No Child Left Behind.
Well, that's so good to hear. So it sounds like we're in the right direction. Digitalized with the family, and then we'll wait for the rest of the information. Oh, that's great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from the site of Annamari Francesca of Asheville Development. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm currently in North Carolina, and I was working in the Florida Early Intervention Program, and we are going through a lot of changes here in North Carolina, as I'm sure probably other states are. I'm finding problems with the assessment tools that we have used here as well as in Florida. As you were mentioning in slide 16, that we are putting the children through something that is not real for them. I feel that some of, you know, it tells us, the regulation tells us that we have to use a standardized score. How can that change? Will that be a national, can that be something that can change nationally, that we are allowed to use other tools such as the ALMS or what have you?
Well, I think we want to have psychometrically sound tools no matter what. And no, I don't think the national reporting system is going to require a specific tool. It probably will be requiring aggregate data, but I don't know that for sure. But I think if you're going to have to use a standardized, what you can do is use a standardized that allows for adaptations, allows for various methods of reporting, including family report, observation, and or you are skilled enough, which I'm sure you are, to be able to do the assessment in a standardized way, yet have the parent participate in doing it and do it through observation. And I think that just basically means that we have to be, we have to work a little bit more creatively to make this more natural than a contrived situation.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Again, if there are any questions, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone now. It appears at this time we, looks like we do have another question. Toby Long of Georgetown University. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Mary Beth, I was wondering how you could respond to the concern, especially from therapists, about documenting frequency and intensity. I know that I actually just spent this morning talking to a group about natural environments, and I think we can get to them, we can get them to a point of, yeah, this is a great idea and we can do it, and giving them suggestions on coming up with functionally based outcomes that are meaningful for families. And then they always ask about, well, you know, how are we documenting frequency and intensity? And when they demand that we put down on the IFSP twice a week, three times a week, whatever, it disallows the flexibility that's so required to really do service in, within a natural environment.
Yeah. Thanks, Toby. I think that's a great issue that we've all been grappling with. Here's, and I just listening to what you said, I picked out a few key words. One is that they say they demand that we do it on the IFSP. Well, it goes back to who's the demand, and don't answer that, who's demanding it, and what's that IFSP for? If it's being used as a billing document, okay, and it's being used for third-party reimbursement, be it Medicaid or private insurance, unfortunately, they're in a bind. But what we have to get people past is to use, is using that document for third-party reimbursement. What people have done in the efforts to make it efficient is use the IFSP for a billing document. And I think that we have seen lots of mistakes being made when we do that, because then people are focusing on frequency and intensity and how many times can I get billed. I think we have to get people, and it may sound like it's, you know, going to give everybody another headache, but we really need to keep the IFSP as pure a process on learning as possible. And then if you have to set up billing documents, you know, we have to figure out a way to do that. And is it increasing paperwork? It might. But I've seen such bad outcomes as a result of trying to keep this in one document. I think it's well worth us figuring out how to do it. And I, going back to, you know, the demands for, I think it is why I'm so interested in systems change and getting people to understand that we can't expect practitioners to do practices that we're not supporting them to do. And that means the whole system has to be invested and involved at looking at what's the most appropriate outcomes, what are the strategies we use, and the model I'm pushing is to look at that IFSP as a living document in how to enhance the family using activity settings, which really is even going beyond functional. You know, it's taking it to not just discipline specific. So, you know, I think what you're hitting is what I'm sure everybody else sitting on this line is hitting too, and it means that we have made some mistakes in trying to do this, and we really, unfortunately, I feel, unless we figure out a way to get out of these mistakes, we're still going down the road of batting our head against the wall trying to do this.
Exactly. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Once again, if there are any questions, please press star 1 now. Take our next question from Beth Tolley of Infant and Toddler. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Mary Beth.
Hi, Beth. How are you? It's all old friends on today.
And if we're talking about using this as a living document and not as the, you're talking about us as
yep.
many others who use it as a dual document.
Yep.
Would you see it as being, how do you see it as a medical record?
Yep.
If it were a living document, then what role would it be play if it were not supporting, if you took out the role in the supporting document as being a billing, what you supporting billing, how would it fall in supporting the medical records part and the all the HIPAA? I'm trying to conceptualize that. Have you thought through that process?
Well, I think again, again, listening to your words, it's we're jumbling a bunch of requirements that we have. We have an IFSP requirement by IDEA, right? It doesn't say anything more about it except it has to have outcomes, integrated goals and objectives. Then we have maybe a requirement for medical records. Is that because of billing? Is that the
no
for billing?
No, medical records has its. You have to document. It's not just the billing. You had medical records requirements before. You had billing requirements. Even if you were not billing, even if you provided free services, you'd have medical records requirements.
And that's a Virginia requirement, do you think? I don't know that for a fact. I don't know.
I would think that would be any requirement. I would think Shriners Hospitals who don't
mm-hmm.
have free services would still have medical records requirements.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what I would do is look at what you're using the medical record for and where is it going, because you're right, when you get into HIPAA for a medical record, then there's a whole lot of other things. Well, at the very least, parents are going to have to sign off on, you know, sharing this record with whoever we think needs to see it, which then maybe cries again that you do need to keep these as two separate documents. I know, creating more work, but...
This is Joycey breaking in. I think that the HIPAA requirements are different than the IFSP. So I think one of the things that HIPAA has clarified is that the IFSP is an educational document, is subject to FERPA concerns rather than HIPAA. And it's more complicated than we can get into right now, but they have done at least that level of clarification.
But if Virginia still wants a medical record, that would be HIPAA.
Yeah.
So then, Beth, you got HIPAA and FERPA together. I think that it's not, and I'm certainly not... I'm empathizing with you because I am not sure on this phone call how to solve it, except I think you guys need to think and think about what makes most sense from your point of view, what's going to enhance best practice for kids and families. Truly, if you keep that vision, and that's what I think why we want to get into shared vision, what do we want for kids and families, and then figure out how the rest of it can fall in, even if it means we're going to have some inconvenient issues going on.
I guess I was curious about how others do it also, if they're using SP without using it as a billing document, are they using it as their...
Right. Well, why don't we see? Does anybody else want to chime in? That would be helpful to find out.
Mary Beth, we're going to have a follow-up discussion online at the TA community website. Perhaps people would pursue it there, or perhaps we could also use our Part C listserv to craft that question.
Great idea, Joycey. Sorry, Beth, I don't have really an answer. I mean, it's just, again, going back to what do we need and why do we need it?
We'll take our next question from Yvonne McMillan of Robeson County. Go ahead, please.
Yes, we're involved in the changeover in early intervention. Anyhow, we're going to have two providers going in the home now instead of one. We have one that will go in and make the initial assessment and one that actually go in with the child play. Instead of having one less, we're having one more going into the home. for special instructions. I just don't know how, you know, this is going to be affecting the children before when it's just one going into the home.
Mm-hmm. I really don't have a comment on that. I think you're sort of saying it in your question. You know, what we really want to do is make families' lives easier, not complicate it. I mean, I truly believe that that's the purpose of early intervention, is to enhance families and facilitate development. And the way we do it is to make life a little easier for them.
Hello?
Yep.
I believe we were cut off.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't really have an answer for you on that. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from the side of Deborah Gurnio of Rhode Island Health Department. Go ahead, please. If you could take your phone off of mute.
Sorry.
Sorry about that. This is Michael Sperry in Rhode Island as well. And another issue that we have been dealing with a lot recently is programs designed for typically developing children versus programs that are not designed for typically developing children. So, for an example, a pool group for children enrolled in EI that is encouraging parents to bring their children out into the community and not to make this a silo, but to encourage community collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't meet our specifics of a program designed for typically developing children. What are your thoughts on that?
You lost me at the why it wouldn't meet program designed for typically developing children. Go back a little bit. I'm sorry.
In that pool group.
Yeah, you've got a group of kids going to the pool, right?
It's only kids enrolled in early intervention.
Oh, okay. So what do you think about it?
We have been trying to apply like two standards. One is the location, and then the other standard that we were looking at is whether it's designed for typically developing or whether it's designed for the general population of that age group.
Uh-huh.
And so we were, you know, kind of having like determining and or evaluating whether it was a natural environment based on those two components.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so stringent compared to other states? You know, our providers are saying it's a little bit stringent, but...
Well, you know, going back to just what I'm saying, I think, you know, if this was identified as an activity setting that the parent already does or wants the child to do, I think we want to do it in the most naturalized way possible. So a group of children with disabilities all going at the same time to a pool, I'm not so sure would fit my definition of criteria of the most natural learning opportunity possible.
Right, okay.
Once again, if there are any questions, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone now. I think we have a question from Cheryl Archer of First Connections. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Mary Beth. How are you?
Good, Cheryl.
You know, of course, I'd beep in.
good.
I had a suggestion that we might want to look at. You were talking earlier, and I understand that the TA community will be looking at the combined IFSP, and I think that's a very good move. But one of the things that we might want to look at the same time is not only as a billing document, because we frankly don't use ours as a billing document. We do have a combined IFSP that meet all the requirements for all of the programs, Medicaid, Part C, education, and Early Head Start. And one of the things that we are looking at, and what the speaker a while ago talked about, the medical records aspect, and also the frequency, intensity, and duration
mm-hmm.
aspect, those are covered under federal law. Medicaid and medical information is a part of the IFSP already, and as far as whether it's used as a billing document or not, I wouldn't really be, in my opinion, that pertinent, because it should be a combined tool, a combined picture of that family's daily living, and it should be a fluid document, and it should be a living document, and can be as a combined document. It meets the needs of all of our programs in Arkansas, and yes, there are some areas that we need to look at and to make more transdisciplinary, and that's one of the things that we're working on in Arkansas. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a billing document to meet all those criteria. Just something that the TA community may want to look at.
I agree. I think where we've sort of gone the wrong path is when we make the IFSP comply to what billing needs to see.
I agree.
Which overrides what we want a kiddo and a family to be learning based on family's activity settings. Because activity settings don't necessarily lend themselves to frequency and intensity of hands-on service delivery. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And I think, going back to Toby's question, and I'm glad you guys are going to have a couple of sessions with therapists, that is the biggest challenge, is because that's how they have been taught to deliver services. And if we're using it, if we're still thinking in terms of that, then sometimes we miss the ballpark in regard to what's really important to the family and child.
Well, where we're having a difficulty in Arkansas, I mean, federal law requires that frequency, intensity, and duration be on the IFST, but where we have a problem is that we're doing too many different services.
Right. Right.
And disciplines at one time, and we don't have, as you were talking about earlier, a specified front person, primary service delivery person that the others collaborate with, and I think that's where we want to go more in Arkansas, but it is a long road.
Yeah.
And it's a hard road to get there.
Well, I'm sure on the TA communities or whatever, what you've done would be very helpful for people to see. And as you move towards that transdisciplinary, even that I would love to see.
Okay. We did write a grant for Health and Human Services, and it didn't get funded. But we haven't given up. We're working with all of our different agencies. We also have a Birth to Three initiative with child care.
Good.
In Arkansas.
That's wonderful. I'm going to remember all these for our Personnel Prep Institute as we start examining practices of personnel training and practice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question is a follow-up from Toby Long of Georgetown University. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to follow up a little bit about the pool, the comment from the folks in Rhode Island about the pool. I also get that question a lot because it's a aquatic type of therapy, and pool therapy is so popular these days. And I guess I always respond sort of in the same way for many things. Our job should be spent, rather than setting up a pool program, is going finding a pool program for kids that already exist and helping the instructor of that pool program accept and integrate appropriate strategies that would make it therapeutic for our children. And that may be much harder for us as providers to do. But I think that comes closer to what you said right at the beginning, Mary Beth, about our job is helping families build their capacity.
Yeah, thanks, Toby. That's a good, good explanation. It takes it that step further, which is great.
Our next question comes from the side of Deborah Mitchum of OPC Area Program. Go ahead, please.
I was just wondering, if the learning opportunities in an activity setting are good quality learning opportunities for all children, does it matter really what the ratio of typically developing children to special needs children is in that setting? I mean, you were saying that it's not so much the setting as it is what happens in that setting. Just wondered what your thoughts are on that.
Right, but I should have prefaced it with the fact that I do not see, and I think since 86 we have been moving away from having a need to keep kids with disabilities just with kids with disabilities. So if I'm looking at activity setting and learning opportunity, I'm looking from the family's point of view and going back to the law where it says what are typical or natural for a child that age. And from a family's point of view, would they be putting their kiddo, except for early intervention, in a group with other kids with disabilities? Probably not. So I would kind of go the route of listening to the family and what's important to them, as opposed to us setting up service system deliveries that kind of kill a couple of birds with one stone.
I think one of the things that we're grappling with now is we've had programs, center-based programs for children for 30 years in the different communities. They're part of the community you know, in each of the counties. In the past, they have been primarily for children with special needs. Now we've moved away from that and have integrated typically developing children in, and we've grappled over, you know, what's inclusive, what's not inclusive, but we really are working more towards it being quality environments for all children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we may have therapists on hand that can work with the children with special needs, but, you know, trying mm-hmm. to do best practice in terms of child care and you know, quality activities that we're providing for all children in the programs. So, you know, there's kind of the struggle, are those appropriate settings for children to be in, and, you know, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of good quality settings for children. And in some of the small rural communities, it may be one of only five child care settings in the whole community, you know, so... to do away with that just because it has in the past been a setting for children with special needs, and it's a program that the community really values and families really, you know, put their kids on a waiting list so that they can go there, it just doesn't seem right just to throw that out just because it has been in the past a setting primarily for children with special needs. So again, we've, you know, really tried to look towards enhancing the environment and including all children, you know, not just focusing on throwing out those programs.
Well, I think, you know, since I don't know what you're talking about and not there, it would do injustice for me to answer you, but I think you need to go back. I guess the hardest part about doing this is to not just try to continue doing what we were doing and try and, as you said, throw the baby out with the bathwater, but maybe I'm here telling you that I think you do have to start over and think differently. And that's, as I said, this is tough stuff. At least my message is tough stuff. You have to think a different way and think a different paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not saying that you wouldn't be able to figure out ways to have kids together doing community-based activities, but I don't think just trying to keep something that seemed to work well in the past and adapting it is probably going to be the answer to this strategy of the natural learning opportunities within activity settings that I'm talking about.
Thank you.
Mary Beth and participants, thank you very much. I think we're about time to start winding down the call. Mary Beth, that was just such an excellent job. I can't thank you enough for starting off our series so well. We have calls continuing every Wednesday, except the Wednesday after next is a week off because of the personnel preparation meeting in D.C. And then after that, continuing on Wednesdays through April into the first week of May with a whole host of presenters, as you can see on our website, that we're looking forward to. Julianne Woods will be joining us next on March 10th. Her supporting webpage will be open Monday afternoon before that call, so you'll have a chance to get in, download the PowerPoint, see what she's going to be speaking on. Let's see. I believe, we have taped this call, and we, of course, I told you earlier that Mary Beth's PowerPoint will be available on the site. We are working out how we will package and disseminate and allow people to order these tapes from the series in the future, and we'll be getting that information out to you as soon as we've made those decisions. So I thank you all for joining us, and I hope you have a great week. Hope you all come back next Wednesday.